Chris?
Christine. The presentation of Judge Werner has been distributed. If we are not winning with the laptop, Christine, I suggest that maybe Judge Werner may take us through the presentation, because all members have the copies, and we thank you very much for that. And are you almost there, Christine? Yeah. We appear to have a problem, a technical problem. Huh? Yeah, I mean, if she has, I'm saying she can take us through. Yeah. Judge, I would be happy. If you are not comfortable, please say so. Yeah, oh, thank you very much. And I think only a woman can think of that. And happy women's, happy belated Women's Day. Judge, you have 10 minutes to present. There it comes. There it is. Ah, then it came. Please mark the time. What time is it now? Okay, thank you very much, Judge. You can, when you feel ready, you can start. My name is Makosi because I'm the chair. I'm just here to ensure that the proceedings are running fairly. If you could just, when you are comfortable, you can start, you can begin. You have 10 minutes.
Thank you. I thank you for the opportunity to address you all this morning. I believe that these presentations will remind us all of the importance of our constitutional democracy and the basis for our moral and ethical values. I've been a High Court judge for the past 5 years, and prior to that, an advocate at the Johannesburg Bar for 33 years. I was appointed senior counsel in 1995. During my time as an advocate, I handled various types of litigation, and as a judge, I deal with different aspects of law on a daily basis. Many of these involve the state and parastatal entities. As both an advocate and a judge, we are bound to a strict code of professional ethics. Advocates are obliged to deal with all cases in which they are briefed, whether they agree with the client's sentiments or not. This pertains even more to my work as a judge. Thus, inculcated in my value system are the traits of fairness, open-mindedness, impartiality, and independence. I'm fully aware of the supremacy of the Constitution and the constitutional mandate of the public protector to support and strengthen constitutional democracy. It would help us to go back to the Kara Asmal report of 2007, which dealt with the reason for the establishment of Chapter 9 institutions. He stated, against the background of an inherited state which was farcically bureaucratic, secretive and unresponsive to the basic needs of the majority of its citizens, these institutions were established to restore the credibility of the state, ensure that the state became more open and responsive to the needs of its citizens and more respectful of their rights. President Mandela in 1996 spoke of the need for Chapter 9 institutions as follows. Even the most benevolent of governments are made up of people with all the propensities for human failings. The administrative conduct of government and authorities are subject to scrutiny of independent organs, such as the public protector. This is an essential element of good governance. And Chief Justice Mogoeng Mogoeng, in the recent EFF decision in the CC, said the following, public office bearers ignore their constitutional obligations at their peril. In a state predicated on a desire to maintain the rule of law, it is imperative that one and all should be driven by a moral obligation to ensure the continued survival of our democracy. In dealing with the role and functions of the public protector, I wish to set out briefly the statutory enactments, other mandates, and the role of the public protector in African and international ombuds associations. Sections 181 and 182 of the Constitution establish the office of the public protector and set out their mandates. In summary, these institutions are independent and subject only to the Constitution and the law, and they must be impartial and exercise their powers and perform their functions without fear, favor, or prejudice. Other organs of state must assist and protect these institutions to ensure the independence, impartiality, dignity, and effectiveness of these institutions. The Public Protector Act in the preamble provides that the public protector has the power, as regulated by national legislation, to investigate any conduct in state affairs or in the public administration in any sphere of government that is alleged or suspected to be improper or to have resulted in impropriety or prejudice, to report on that conduct and take appropriate remedial action. The public protector is accountable to the National Assembly and must report on its activities at least once a year. The public protector has a central role in promoting ethical government and combating crime. To quote Advocate Tuli Maroncella, the purpose of the public protector institution is to provide swift justice for ordinary people, to help them exact accountability for administration wrongs in state affairs. The powers are set out succinctly in the Public Protector Act, and in particular in Sections 6 and 7, and they basically provide for the way in which the Public Protector is to fulfil the constitutional mandate. However, the Public Protector's powers are proactive and were set out in the Mail and Guardian, the Public Protector versus the Mail and Guardian case in the Supreme Court of Appeal, where the Supreme Court of Appeal highlighted the following. The Act confers upon the public protector sweeping powers to discover information. He or she may call for explanations, may require any person to appear for examination, may call for the production of documents, and premises may be searched upon the issue of a judicial officer's warrant. The public protector is not a passive adjudicator between citizens and the state. His or her mandate is an investigatory one, requiring proaction in appropriate circumstances. He or she may also take the initiative to commence an inquiry into maladministration or impropriety in public life. The powers also include the option to mediate and or negotiate. If such measures fail, a report can be issued calling for compliance, which is a unique form of access to justice. It is pertinent to point out that there are several Chapter 9 institutions whose powers may overlap. There's been some debate about whether there should rather be an umbrella body, as suggested by Kada Asmal. However, a single agency has one distinct disadvantage. If the lone anti-corruption body faces political capture, the independence of the entire system is compromised. A multiplicity of agencies provides checks and balances and are essential in the South African context. The Forum for Institutes Supporting Democracy deals with some of these overlaps and looks for ways for these institutions to cooperate. The powers of the public protector were clarified in regard to their effect in the recent case in the Constitutional Court of EFF versus the Speaker and others. In summary, Chief Justice stated, the public protector has very wide powers that leave no level of government power above scrutiny. She is not to be inhibited, undermined, or sabotaged. Her investigative powers are not supposed to bow down to anybody. If compliance with remedial action were optional, very few culprits, if any, would allow it to have that effect. Her remedial action has a binding effect. Reference was also made to this judgment of the SCA in SABC versus the DA. The public protector cannot realize her constitutional purpose of her office if organs of state can second-guess her findings and ignore her recommendations. The public protector has additional powers prescribed by national legislation. I won't go through all, they're set up on the screen. However, some are important, including the Executive Members Ethics Act, which empowers the public protector to investigate all allegations of violations of the Act and the Code by members of the executive. The public protector is the sole agency for the enforcement of this code. The Anti-Corruption Act and Protected Disclosures Act also recognize the public protector's role to investigate state action and take remedial action. Other mandates include Chapter 14 of the National Development Plan, which deals with promoting accountability and fighting corruption, the Sustainable Development Goals Agenda 2063, the public protector's responsible for reducing corruption and strengthening accountability. In Africa, the public protector is the executive secretary of AOMA, the African Ombuds and Mediators Association, and plays a role in the African Ombuds Association Research Center. These institutions seek cooperation throughout Africa through sharing best practices. The public protector is also involved internationally in the International Ombuds Institute, an independent global body which deals regionally with complaints relating to public administration. In the Public Protector's Strategic Review Report for 2016 to 2021, challenges have been identified which have been or still need to be dealt with. There are various, and they appear on the board, and I won't go through all as there isn't time. But what one can see from this extensive list and the dates recommended for implementation, that one can discern that much has already been accomplished in dealing with these challenges. It would be the duty of the next public protector to investigate what has not been done and what progress has been achieved in areas which have not yet been completed. This one can only accomplish once one has entered the office and done a due diligence. The draft public protector rules were published for comment in 2010, but having regard to the recent judgment...
Sorry, Judge, you have 2 more minutes to go.
Oh, well, then I better go too. Why me? That's the right time. Okay. I have a non-wavering belief in the rule of law and its applicability to all persons, more particularly those in positions of power. I feel strongly about injustice and will endeavor to do all things to right such wrongs. In this position, one can do even more than one can as a judge. I have the ability to apply an open and unbiased and inquiring mind and proactively investigate issues. Based upon my previous experience, I'm aware of the dilatory and costly implications of litigation and would therefore use my skills as an accredited mediator to engage parties in mediation prior to litigation. As a judge, I deal with large volumes of reading material and am able to quickly discern issues that need to be further investigated and have thus honed my analytical skills. I do complete tasks efficiently, having been accustomed to time constraints applicable to both the work of an advocate and a judge. I've administered the entire advocacy program for the upskilling of young advocates, and I would seek to do this to upskill existing staff of the public protector. I'm a member of the case management committee dealing with management procedures and litigation in the High Court. I believe that one needs to remedy the situation with Parliament by engaging more actively with all role players and stakeholders. In regard to constitutional values, I've throughout my career employed those values and have championed the Constitution and been involved in transformation in the legal profession through advocacy skills and my work on the GCB. I've enshrined the Constitution wherever necessary in dealing with issues of the right to housing, the rights of children, freedom of expression, and other rights. I'm aware of the complexities with state bureaucracies work, but they have to still act and in a way that is not acting with impunity in dealing with citizens. This involves road accident victims, refugees, those unlawfully arrested, and those suffering at the hands of state facilities. I've been involved in ways to minimize the effects of judgments in respect of evictions and foreclosures by formulating practice directives which have gone to the Rules Board so that banks must exhaust all attempts to prevent foreclosure. I've also been involved, together with the JP of Gauteng, Dunstan Malambo, in establishing the pro bono help desk at the Johannesburg High Court.
At your time is up.
Okay.
Or you want to finish one line?
Just one last thing.
Okay.
As a leader, I follow the philosophy that great leaders don't set out to be a leader, they set out to make a difference. Any questions?
Thank you, Judge. I hope the members understand now why completing a task is so important. So I'm trying to complete a task. Anyway, members, Honorable Motapo, Honorable Maisela, Honorable Tseke, then Honorable Breitenbach, and Honorable On, and yeah, and you will come in after in the next round, Honorable Kurnov.
I presume I may be seated now.
Yes, you may.
I feel comfortable. Yes, Honorable Motapo.
Oh, thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, Judge.
Good morning.
My name is Moremadi Motapo.
Yes.
Judge, in your 5 years tenure as a judge, you did deliver several judgments, mostly timelessly. However, there are some which were delivered after 3 months. We'll dwell on that.
Yes.
However, most are not relevant to the most of the judgments, rulings which you made were not relevant to the position of public protector, the legal experience you have. And while in practice, your areas of specialization was corporate law.
Yes.
So in your own view, with this experience that you have, do you regard yourself as being a fit and proper or having relevant experience commensurate to the position of public protector? What is your take on that? And secondly, the delays in delivering judgments within the set norms and standards in terms of performance of judicial functions. May you kindly comment on that? Thank you.
Yes, let me deal with that first. There are two judgments outstanding, both of which are appeals in which I'm not the scribe. I am not the person who was nominated by the senior judge to do the judgment. There are appeal judgments. There were three judges. I wasn't the scribe. So I in fact have one judgment outstanding which was supposed to be delivered last Friday, but I had to be at the rules board for the discussions on foreclosure, so I couldn't deliver it, but it's ready for delivery. That's the only judgment I have outstanding. None of my other judgments have ever taken longer than 3 months. In fact, most are done within a month, and only the two appeal judgments are outstanding as far as I'm aware. Is there anything further you'd like me to answer on that particular question?
There are judgments which have been outstanding for more than 3 months. I don't know where I did put that. I'll come back to
you. Can come. There are judgments. You must keep that in mind, according to her. Yes, Honorable Maisela. The other question, are you going to answer that question now, or shall we take the next question? Or you want to answer all her questions?
I can answer the question.
Okay, go on.
Yes, it is correct that during my career as an advocate, I did mainly commercial law, but in the years after the Constitution was enacted, all of the work one does has some constitutional element within it, and one has to look to developing the common law in accordance with the Constitution. As a judge, I deal daily on a basis with constitutional issues, such as the right to housing, the right to education, the right to health, the right not to be unlawfully deprived of one's freedom. These are matters that we see in the motion court in Johannesburg at least 30 a day, and I deal with them every couple of weeks. So insofar as that is concerned, my commercial practice is one thing, but I have, I'm well aware of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, and in the judgments that we now hand down, most of them contain some element of constitutional law.
Okay, thank you. You
yes,
want to?
Yes,
okay.
She caught it. Yeah, okay. Thank you, Chairperson. Judge, I may not spell it correctly. Fatosh versus Kumale and Nodia versus Road Accident Fund. These cases were delivered 3 days after the three-month time period expired.
Sorry, what is the name of the case?
FATOCHE versus Kumalo.
Yes.
And Nodia versus Road Accident Fund.
Yes.
Yes. Another one is the state versus Luruli.
That yes. case was a rape of paramedics which took 3 years to hear. So I delivered the judgment as soon as I could after the case actually ended. I had to analyze all of that evidence, but I don't recall that it was. Was it more than 3 months, are you saying? Fatur.
And Nodia versus Road Accident Fund,
yes,
which was delivered 3 days after 3 month period.
Yes, the 3 month period is the suggested period. There are times when it's very difficult because, for instance, if one in vacation, when one is given time to write judgments, one may be given urgent court to do as well. So it may set one back. I think the norms and standards are very useful. But one has to consider that the Gauteng local division and the Gauteng provincial, the Gauteng division, are the busiest courts in the country. So judges in countries, in jurisdictions that hear one case a week, are subject to the same norms and standards that we are hearing. We don't get a break to write judgments ever. We're in different courts every single week. We write judgments at night, on weekends, and in recess if we can. So occasionally it might happen that it's slightly more than 3 months. But I have delivered, I don't know, maybe 400 judgments. So if one or two were over the three-month period, I apologize for that, but that's what sometimes happens.
Okay, thank you. Honorable Maisana.
Thank you, Chair. Judge, would you please analyze for this committee the significance of the Public Protector's Office in terms of its historical underpinnings, current priorities, its contribution to the building of a national democratic society, and how the office will assist the state in improving on its contribution on its constitutional obligations in enhancing the objectives of the developmental state?
Well, the Constitution itself establishes the Office of the Public Protector and states that the institution is independent and subject only to the Constitution and the law. The important thing is that other organs of state, through legislative and other measures, are supposed to assist and protect these institutions to ensure their independence, impartiality, and effectiveness. And no organ of state may interfere with the functioning of these institutions. They're only accountable to the National Assembly insofar as reports are concerned. Now, the Public Protector's Office can either, on a complaint, investigate improper conduct, or he or she can do it on her own. They're also accessible to all persons. That is one of the challenges, is that access has unfortunately been slightly curtailed because of budget constraints that the office has. Some regional offices have had to be closed and outreach programs have had to be cancelled because there is simply not enough funds for these. The other thing is that in terms of Section 181.2, the Public Protector has the powers to investigate virtually all state affairs other than court decisions. And in this way, the Public Protector's Office is there to see that these state authorities uphold constitutional values, and as is set out in the powers, as I've set out in the EFF versus the Speaker and SABC versus DA, the constitutional purpose of our office can only be recognized if the state doesn't second-guess the findings. In fact, it's supposed to be the outcome of investigations should be to reaffirm shared values. From the reports of the Public Protector, it appears that most parties do, in fact, listen to the remedial action and act thereon. It is the minority of cases where resistance is comes to the fore, and these are the cases that obviously appear in courts or are in the media. So I believe that one has to engage more with Parliament and with political parties, more particularly in regard to their ethics code, so that one can inculcate into public servants the constitutional values that they are supposed to uphold. and this consultation with Parliament and with other organs of government is essential. Perhaps it can be done by way of workshops, seminars, presentations, and but as I say, most of the public sections have complied, and most of the cases, in fact, of the public protector are settled through dispute resolution mechanisms, not by litigation. So these mechanisms do assist in getting people together in trying to resolve these issues so that the constitutional mandate of the public protector is upheld.
And we have Honorable, you have a follow-up?
I just wanted you to emphasize how the office is going to help in the building of the National Democratic Society and also the developmental state aspect of it. Because in some of the judgments about housing, where people are living in squalor, and your judgment, I think is yours, says that if you don't have another alternative, you cannot evict them. And this creates a lot of problem, and as far as health and other social imperatives are concerned in this judgment, it creates an enormous strain on the lives of the people and also on the ability of the state to cope.
I understand the question better now. Since the decision in the Constitutional Court, the Pitchy decision, our courts have taken the view that we have to actively investigate, even if persons who are evicted are about to be evicted do not oppose. We actually call upon them and the municipality to deliver a report on their personal circumstances, the household that they're in, if they're children, women, disabled persons, in an attempt to get some sort of balance between the rights of those seeking to evict them and those who are being evicted. In regard to banks and foreclosures, that's a different issue because those are people who do have money. The big problem, however, is that when one calls upon the municipality to supply alternative accommodation, they don't have any. And what's happening is that the housing processes that they are trying to introduce are being set back by the fact that they have to accommodate people who are being evicted when they are unlawfully occupying buildings. So this is something that has to be dealt with at a government level as to how to balance these two things, because there are people who are entitled to housing, who are waiting for housing, and these procedures are being set back by the fact that the municipalities then have to move displaced people into those particular housing areas. So it is a very difficult balancing act that one has, because one has not only people being evicted by large corporations or government and state institutes, but by some other person who has managed to get together some money to buy a house. Now they can't get the person that's in there out because that person doesn't have anywhere to go. So it is a very difficult problem that we have to try and deal with on a daily basis, trying to balance the interests of different people.
Honorable Maisela, if you could be very brief, sir, because we need to give other members an opportunity
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. But in this particular instance, the people themselves hijack buildings.
Yes.
They act unlawfully.
Yes.
And the owner of the building then goes to the city and says they must find the alternative for these people according to your judgment. But is it the city's problem that broke the law in the first place?
Yes.
And then ran to the law to protect him?
No, doesn't happen. Sorry. When people hijack buildings, the courts have no problems in evicting them. And sometimes it is very sad because there are women and children involved. But what has happened is the people who hijack the buildings, in fact, collect the rentals themselves. So this is creating an enormous problem because the people are paying, but the people who've hijacked are vandalizing the buildings and collecting the rentals. So the owner is not only getting no money, his building is being vandalized, it's becoming dangerous. So in those instances when people take the law into their own hands, unfortunately, if one can look at it in that way, one cannot protect everybody. But one tries to protect people who have nowhere to go, who happen to be in an informal settlement, and then somebody comes and decides to evict them. Those are the type of people that one tries to protect in finding alternative accommodation for.
Okay, I will have to move on to Honorable Tseke.
Thank you very much, Chair, and good morning, Judge Wena. Good
morning.
My name is Grace Tseke. The Group 1 Chambers of Advocates, I think that's the one that have nominated you,
yes,
for this position. They felt that, amongst others, Judge Wena possesses a great passion of skills transfer to young members of a profession. And she continuously gives expression to that passion through the tireless work of as an advocacy trainer. And she's doing this despite her great demands of a work as a judge in the High Court. Given the fact, or with the experience that you are having and the passion for the work, for your work, if you are appointed as the public protector, how are you going to make sure that you strengthen the provincial offices of the public protector? Remember, we've got provinces, provincial offices, and regional offices, though you have indicated that some are closed. Yes, it's because of financial constraints. But how are you going to make sure that we capacitate or we strengthen the provincial offices so that people can get services closer to them? And the second question, it's suppose you're a public protector, you receive a complaint and an allegation of financial impropriety against a public office bearer of the national legislative arm of the state. How would you respond to such a complaint if you are appointed as a public protector? Thank you very much.
Well, let me start with the training aspect first.
Sorry, Judge. Yes. You know, I'm just thinking that maybe I must take a few questions.
Oh, and answer
so that you can answer them, because we have to make sure that each candidate is allocated about an hour. Is that okay
That's
with you, Judge?
Fine. Yes.
Thank you very much. Honorable Pretenbach?
Good morning, Judge Wena. I'm Clarence Breitenbach.
Good morning.
Going through the questionnaire that you filled in for the candidates for Parliament in paragraph 2.2, you have an interesting view on the Office of a Public Protector, the fighting corruption, and the alignment of the office with the National Development Plan. Now, could you briefly just elaborate on that view? Paragraph 2.2 on page 5.
Yeah, I'm looking at it now.
Page 5, paragraph 2.2.
Sorry, I apologize. Which paragraph are you? Which portion?
It's page 5, paragraph 2.2.
Yes.
The question is simply... you have an interesting view on the Office of the Public Protector, fighting corruption, and alignment with the NDP.
Yes.
If you could just very briefly elaborate on that.
About the NDP?
Well, on the alignment, fighting corruption, and the Office of the Public Protector.
Well, the NDP is called NDP 203 in Chapter 14, deals with the promotion and accountability and fighting of corruption. And the public protector is called upon to establish certain functionaries and to strengthen accountability and responsibility of public servants by creating an open and responsive public service, by creating transparency to public accountability, and by trying to get the different agencies, the multi-agency, the agencies that all deal with corruption, in some way to all work together. So it, she has to strengthen the multi-agency corruption service, strengthen the position and the protection of whistleblowers, centralize the awarding of large tenders or tenders with long duration, and give greater teeth to tender compliance. So one of the main objects will be the monitoring of tenders, because that seems to have been one of the major contributions to corruption in the country. So strengthening the monitoring and watchdog effect on tenders and seeing that they are properly handled and then properly investigated if necessary. The strengthening of the protection of whistleblowers, although covered in the National Disclosures Act, there still has to be some development in that regard in how whistleblowers are protected. They are not yet in place, as far as I'm aware, proper ways in which the adequate security can be provided. There will be other bodies other than the Public Protector and the Auditor General who will strengthen measures in regard to the security of whistleblowers. There's also the suggestion that large tenders should be centralized so that there is, it's because it's now so complex that it's impeding effective government. The complexity of the procurement law is working to the detriment of those in regard to providing goods to the state if they are not large organizations or if they don't comply in some other way. And there is we see a lot in courts of trying to set aside tenders and awards because of the non-compliance with procurement legislation. So that is something that will have to be monitored more so than it is presently.
Judge, I allowed you to answer her questions, but the procedure that I had adopted was that you were going to listen to all the questions. And Breitenbach does have this tendency, you know, but I'm going to manage her, don't worry. Honorable Tseke.
As fond as I am of you, for you it's Honorable Breitenbach.
Honorable Tseke had a question. Let me take Honorable On, and if you could please listen to Honorable On's question, then after that you can answer their questions, both of them. I am going to give you, I would start with you in the next round, Honorable Kurenov. Okay, I'm a very fair chairperson, don't worry.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, Judge.
Sorry, before that, can I ask members to please switch off their cell phones? It's interfering with the sound system and the audibility. I received a note. Please, members. Sure, sorry. You may proceed.
Thank you. Judge, in your presentation, you referred to the need that the public protector must deliver what you quoted as to be swift justice. And then we have the clarification of the functions or the binding nature of the findings of the public protector. And now as a judge and really as a lawyer, how do you see the balance between delivering swift justice while adhering to the rules of natural justice in your investigations and ultimately not duplicating the functions of our courts?
Okay, Judge, you may answer.
Oh, must I not wait?
No, you may answer those two, because this is the first round. I wanted us to be done with this round. Then I'm going to take another round.
Oh, I see, okay. Well, one of the challenges that was put up on the board is that there is an attempt to standardize procedures within the Public Protector's Office and to have templates and procedures that would enable people to work at a certain level. The Public Protector rules are also essential for this because they deal with the swift way in which one is supposed to deal with a complaint, the procedure, how to resolve it. So the laws of natural justice obviously will involve audi alteram partem, and whoever happens to be being investigated will be entitled to have their say. So I think it's a question of standardizing and resolving to put in procedures that make it easier for prompt delivery. And that requires the human resources of the office to be motivated, to all be working towards the same goal, to have the same awareness of the constitutional value that they're operating towards, because it appears that from the challenges that are being faced, one of them is that there is low staff morale because of the lack of funding. The other issues which have to be dealt with, and I'm not sure whether they have yet been dealt with. For instance, in the challenges, standard operating procedures and templates were to be introduced by April 2016. Now, one would only be able to see that once one is in the office, whether this has actually been done. There is also a skills audit which has to be done on a regular basis, and monitoring of the employees in performance and compliance with performance management and development systems. Also, what needs to be developed, and it appears it's in development stages, is a case management and project management system. Once this is done and what is looked for is that it is done technologically and that there is one case management system so that things can be properly done. As I understand at the moment, there is not a fully operative ICT structure in place which can deal with case management. So those are some of the problems which one has to deal with, and unfortunately funding constraints do play a part. There are discussions going on with external agencies, foreign agencies who would work within government-to-government agreements and provide funds such as the EU and certain other democratic organizations in Germany, Japan, United States, Norway. So I think it's very important that funding is accomplished so that one can deal with certain of these problems. The public protector rules will also help, as I've said, in this regard. And some of the other problems, which were the challenges, which were identified, seem to be being dealt with. For instance, the ICT technology is supposed to have been assessed by August this year and redesigned by March 2017. So I think one needs to develop procedures where people work quickly but efficiently, and that they're not ignoring certain aspects of natural justice in their investigation and in their reporting, that is all done, but it has to be done in a more efficient manner. And one of the ways in doing that is upskilling people, training them, and perhaps this is answering one of the other questions there, that I believe that although the incumbent has suggested that there be an external panel of experts in regard to things such as legal experts, forensic experts, I believe that one can upskill the existing staff, and that would be more cost effective and also would create a greater morale amongst the employees that they can work towards something together. So one hopes to balance that to get a swift procedure, but not in any way abandoning the rules of natural justice.
Thank you, Honorable Kurnov, Honorable Swart, Honorable Floyd Chivambu. I'm noting you, and Honorable Van Damme, you'll come after Honorable Chivambu. I said Kurnov, Swart, Chivambu, then Van Damme.
Thank you, Chairperson. Judge, according to your CV, in March 1999, you were called to the Bar of England and Wales. Now, I assume you did a pupillage and you wrote the necessary exams. Please correct me if you did not. But why did you decide to do it? I'm just curious on that one. Secondly, we all know that we have a shortage of women judges on the bench. Will you not serve South Africa better by remaining in the judiciary? I would like your comments on that. And then finally, In your opinion, what constitutes the independence of the Public Protector's Office?
Must I answer? Or
no, wait. Let's take Honorable Swart. You've been doing very well. Just come in, Honorable Swart.
Thank you, Chair. Very briefly, Judge, following on the last question, how do you see the relationship between the Public Protector and Chapter 9 institutions in general and Parliament? And that would also then link to, you made brief reference to the funding constraints that in the Public Protector's Office, and you, I would ask you as a judge, in view of the Constitutional Court decision, the EFF judgment, it would appear that there are going to be far more reviews where government departments take the Public Protector on review. How would you deal with the additional funding constraints and such additional reviews? It seems that that's a given. It's going to take, and it's going to place a lot of obstacles and pressure on the Public Protector's Office. Thank you.
Vambu.
No, thank you, Chairperson. So in your slides,
yes,
presentation in the bioscope, you showed when you asked the question of why me, you said you are driven by a strong sense of justice.
Yes.
You went to university in the 1970s and you started practicing after that. And you went to university, you graduated at Wits in 1972, 1976, somewhere there.
Yes.
Yes.
A long time ago.
Yeah, it was a long time ago. But during that time, there was uprising against apartheid in South Africa. And apartheid was the most inhuman form of injustice against black people. What was your role in the struggle against apartheid? Were you participating in the fight against apartheid? Did you support apartheid, or you were just not interested? It was just one of those things that is happening. What was your role in that struggle? That is one. Two is much more clarity in terms of your understanding of the relationship. I think Honorable Swart has spoken to that, the relationship between the Public Protector's Office and Parliament. And the last question is, what do you think should happen to members of the executive who have been instructed to comply to the remedial actions and they do not do so? What do you think should happen beyond that, much more practically? Because I think there's lots of limitations in terms of what is provided for in that regard. And lastly is the Executive Members Ethics Act defines a role of the Public Protector and says that once there's a complaint against a member of the executive, the Public Protector must investigate the breach and report to the president. But it doesn't say who the Public Protector must report to if the president is the one who is involved in the violation of the executive code, ethics code. What do you think should happen to fill that gap that exists, which was a big issue with the incumbent Public Protector? Thank you.
Okay, Judge, let me give you an opportunity to respond to those three questions. And I must advise you that I still have a lot of questions. There are quite a few other members that want to respond. If you could try and be crisp with your answers. Yes. Thank you.
Yes, in regard to being a member of the Bar of England and Wales, I was doing a lot of advocacy training in South Africa and in England with the Inns of Court, and it was suggested that I should become a member. In fact, I'd already taken silk in South Africa, so I was excused from pupillage, and because of my advocacy training experience, I was excused from practical training because it was basically the training we were doing. I have, however, never practiced there. It was just something that I did at the time. In regard to women in the judiciary, there are quite a lot of women in the judiciary, and I think that simply staying there because there should be more women in the judiciary is not necessarily the way I would look at things. I can tell you that in the next batch of applicants, there are about 10 women who have applied just in my division alone. So it seems that there are many more women. What's happening is that women are now being recognized more at the bar, at the sidebar, and when they're coming to the bench, they have the experience and they therefore are getting appointed. So that aspect is definitely balancing out. So I just feel that in my position and as a judge, and there is something more I can do because it's a more proactive role. And there's sometimes people appear in front of me and I only wish I could be doing the investigation into that case or the preparation, because there's just a lot of people who just don't do the preparation and the investigation, and therefore the case falls apart. So I hope that that would do that. In regard to the relationship with Chapter 9 institutions and Parliament, it's quite clear from the Constitution and from the Public Protector Act that the institutions are independent and subject only to the Constitution and law, and therefore they are not answerable to Parliament other than to report and account to Parliament in respective reports. So it is quite clear that we are living in a constitutional democracy and not a parliamentary democracy, and that the powers of the Public Protector are independent of Parliament and that they cannot be interfered with. In fact, in section 181, sub 3, no organ of the state, other organs of the state must assist and protect these institutions, either through legislative or other measures. So it is something that might be a dream that we're hoping for in accomplishing, to get the executive to adhere to remedial action and not go on review as much as might be anticipated. Yes, for funding for reviews, well, it's a very interesting question, because as you say, there are going to be more reviews, because that is the only way to get around the remedial action. You can't simply ignore it. And it might be that the Public Protector has to apply to Treasury to say, look, this is not really our fault. This is Parliament or an executive member or a member of some parastatal organization who is not complying. And we are being taken on review. It's not our action. And we need to be funded in that regard in order to do that. As I stated, there are some organizations, but those organizations mainly give funding towards outreach programs and special projects. So it might be just approaching Parliament, as they've done now for the latest report, to get an extra 1.5 million. But if one looks at the budget, it seems that there is definitely an imbalance. I think, if I'm not talking out of turn, the SIU has a budget of some 1.9 billion. Not that much. Well, certainly much more than the Public Protector, whose budget is about 480 million. So it seems that there are certain organizations that have much more money available, and they're able, therefore, to do a more intense job. So money is always a problem everywhere. Mr. Shivambu. Okay, so when I was at university, I was a member of, in those days, NUSAS. I stood on Jan Smuts Avenue with posters about bring down apartheid, and was part of, started off one of the, as one of the founding members of Lawyers for Human Rights in South Africa. I was part of the what was the precursor to the Wits Law Council in those days for dealing with indigent or oppressed people. When I started out at the bar, my pupil master, in fact, did so many cases in all of the magistrates' court around South Africa, defending young blacks who had been caught holding a Free Mandela coffee cup, basically, and these people were all charged. So I was involved in many of those cases, getting them off. And I must say there were some magistrates who still thought this was an absolutely heinous offense, but there were some who actually saw that this type of thing simply couldn't go on. So at university, those were, you know, the things that I did. I was one of the protesters, and it was one with funny incidents, although it's not funny when you look back at it, is that I remember the students who were protesting in Cape Town were chased into a church. And that afternoon, the Springboks were playing a rugby match and they lost. And the big posters were Jesus punishes, box lose. So those were the type of things that you know, people kind of used to do at university level in those days. So what I did was work where I could with legal resources, with the Legal Resources Center, with the Lawyers for Human Rights, and do what I could in assisting those persons who couldn't afford other legal assistance. And that was my fight against apartheid. I've always been found the system so unjust. It used to cause great frustration in my life, insofar as having to live in a country at that time that was committing the heinous acts that it was.
Honorable Shivampu, I think, are you happy with the response? Can I proceed?
Other questions?
Yes.
Yes, let's get other questions.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Sorry, what was the second question? Yeah,
the second question and the third question, yes.
Well, if remedial action is not adhered to, the public protector does have certain powers. The rules will provide for contempt of court proceedings, but there have been other proceedings where the public protector has gone to court, had the person found in contempt, and for instance, that particular person received a fine. So it would have to depend on the particular misdemeanor that had been committed. But those powers are now that the Constitutional Court has said that her remedial action is binding. It has the effect of a court order. So a person can be held in contempt. And some of the judges of our division have now been calling ministers and claims managers and et cetera when things are not done the way they're supposed to be done in court. And we are calling upon them to show, as the Labour Court did recently, why the particular person in charge of that particular organisation shouldn't pay the costs personally. And that is one of the ways in which the remedial action can be dealt with, because it's usually against an institution, and if it's against an institution, basically at the end of the day, the taxpayer is paying the fine. But if it's that person in particular who has to pay themselves, it does make a difference.
Thank you very much, Judge. I'm going to take questions very quickly. Honorable Floyd, I still have other members here.
I appreciate
who
it, but I wanted to get
a
response. When maybe we should respond to the next round of questions to respond to the issue on the role of the president in the context of the Executive Members Ethics Act. That specifically, what happens if a president is the one who's being complained against? What should happen?
I think if you could note that question, and there is also a question that was from Honorable Tseke on the allegation, or how would you deal with the allegation of impropriety against a public office bearer? I think that was the question from Honorable Tseke. Can I take all these people, all the members, the following members, Honorable Van Damme, followed by Honorable Bongo, then Honorable Masondo, Honorable Mwabe, and I think I would also want to ask my question. Thank you.
Thanks, Chairperson. Morning, Judge Wiener. My name is Phumzile Van Damme. Yes. I think the current public protector has had a very tumultuous term. She's had to deal with lots of political attacks from, you know, politicians, from political parties, from members of portfolio committees, and lots of those attacks have been really personal. Mm. Have you had any experience of dealing with political pushback to any of your judgments? I think it's a very important skill to have if you are to become public protector, a skill with knowing how to deal with political attacks. So do you have an example of where you've had to deal with political pushback? How did you respond? How did you deal with that? And then is it your view that Chapter 9 institutions are not answerable to Parliament and only report to Parliament? Is that your view? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good morning, madam.
Yes.
On page number 3 on the presentation.
Yes. Sorry, which particular?
Here.
Oh, sorry. Yes. Yes.
Page number 3, you refer to the issue that the public projector must be independent. And in responding to one of the questions, you have also said that you think it must be independent from Parliament. I just want you to emphasize, even by way of example, your understanding of this independence. What constitutes the independence of the public protector in relations to the other 3 spheres of government? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Many would agree that the relationship between the public protector and other institutions of the state should not be antagonistic. In your view,
antagonistic to?
Antagonistic to each other, one institution to the other.
Yeah.
In your view, what is the balance?
Sorry, when you say antagonistic to each other, are you talking about the 3 levels of government or the 3 spheres of government or intergovernmental agencies or different departments?
It's basically a question that has to do with intergovernmental relations. Intergovernmental relations and the role of the public protector, of office of the public protector in this regard. And how do you avoid antagonistic type relations and in your view, what should the balance be?
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, Judge. Judge, I think you would agree with me if I say whether we're a politician, an academic, a judge, a professional, but at the end of the day, you must play a part in developing your own society because in its own, that proves a sense of patriotism. Mm. Now, I want you to tell me more about this Warm the World, the NPO that you founded in 2012.
Yes.
What is really happening there? Where do you get your funding? Which communities are you servicing? Thank you.
Judge, just a question from me.
Yes.
You've pointed out, and correctly so, that South Africa loses over 30 billion per annum due to corruption. And obviously, given the fact that corruption is a major threat to Africa's development path, not just here in South Africa, but generally, it's a major, major, major threat to our development path. Now, I also heard you to be saying something about the need for, if I understood you correctly, for more resources, possibly, for the Office of the Public Protector. But currently, South Africa is going through a very serious low economic growth trap. And when you are experiencing that period, you obviously have to reprioritize your spending. And usually, infrastructure is always the area that you would tend to focus your spending on. Now, how do you propose that we address the challenges of the budget of the public protector? But at the same time, I also wanted to know what sort of remedies that will be assisting the national fiscus, because it's good to say we are losing 30 billion, but how much of that money are we able to recover becomes very important. Now, how are you going to deal with those issues? The second one is around the linguistic landscape in South Africa. You have two blocks of the linguistic landscape in South Africa. You have the linguistic landscape of the colonial order, and largely your Afrikaans, your English, and you have your African origin linguistic landscape. Now, given the fact that we have 11 official languages in South Africa, and we are also trying to create a socially cohesive society, what do you see your role as the public protector in actually integrating the society and making sure that this linguistic divide, which is very much linked to economics as well, that somehow we find a way of dealing with that aspect? And maybe you might also share with us what sort of languages can you speak, if we can speak, you know, some of the languages and so forth. Believe you me, I love Helen Zille sometimes when she speaks Xhosa. She speaks well. And the final one, I want to get your, if you can give us practical examples of how you would balance high-profile cases with your ordinary cases. And we have to strike that balance, because currently you will actually find that we tend to focus more on high-profile cases. And yes, it's very important. And I said to you, corruption is a real threat, but we need also to be balancing that with the cases of ordinary people. And maybe to me, it may not matter that I've been shortchanged in the local government in terms of rates, my property with 30,000 rand, the municipality maybe takes that property from me. But and maybe if you compare that with something else, it might actually mean, ah, this is a small case. Now, I'm talking about cases like that when I'm talking about low-profile cases. How do we balance that? Anyway, that's for you. Thank you.
Okay. Can I answer now?
Yes, ma'am. Is there any member that I have left out? Okay, everybody has answered.
Well, Honorable Shivambu is not here, so I think it was his question about what happens if the ethics are violated by the president and the report has to go to the president. Well, I think that's exactly what happened in the Nkandla issue. So although the report goes to the president, if remedial action is suggested, that is the action the president has to take, and if he doesn't, then there are parties, as there have been, who will see that a court of law does see that the remedial action is implemented. In regard to political attacks, I'm trying to recall whether any of my judgments have resulted in a political attack. I don't think so. Not that I can recall that there were political attacks on a particular judgment. There are discussions around, for instance, the banks who seem to think that the courts are being too lenient in regard to foreclosures and evictions, because there are certain things where you can serve a document at a domicilium where the person doesn't live. And we have insisted that if you're going to take someone's house away, you serve on them personally. So there's small issues like that which have caused not so much political discourse, but some sort of debate around whether or not this is correct. And that has resulted in the rules of court now being amended because of that. In regard to Warm the World, it's a small NPO. It's not an enormous NPO. I founded it in 2012. What it does is we get wool donated, which we put in doctors' rooms. For those of you from Gauteng and a few from Cape Town, if you go to a doctor, there's always a basket of wool where you can knit just a row or whatever, and then those are made into squares. We collect the squares. We then have about 20 to 30 unemployed women in Hillbrow, Hammanskraal, Soweto, and we have taught them how to sew these together, and we pay them for sewing them together from funds we've collected from donations and from funding events. And then those blankets are distributed throughout the country to people in need and people in crisis. For instance, when there was the problem in Tembisa, we try to get blankets there to assist them. So we try to do it on an ad hoc crisis basis as well. We also get a lot of blankets that are not knitted, but ready-made donated to us, which we then distribute to the homeless and to various other beneficiaries and organizations. I think to date we've distributed about 50,000 blankets in the last few years. Yes, Africa, corruption, more resources, serious low economic growth, and the balance. Obviously, there have to be priorities, and it depends where one looks at one priorities. I look at the corruption and the damaging effect that it has on the country or on the continent as something that is a great priority. Because if that corruption wasn't happening, that $30 billion a year could be used for all those other initiatives and essential operations that are necessary for South Africa and for Africa. So one does understand the budget constraints, but I think one has to look, the Treasury needs to look within its budgets as to who is getting such a high proportion of the budget and who's getting such a low proportion, and see whether or not, in fact, that is a correct balance. As I've said, there are outside funding that can be done through government-to-government agreements, and there are many organizations in Africa and in Europe and America who have anti-corruption funding organizations that are done through national treasury so that there is no sort of conditions attached, etc. So I would consider that corruption and crime are one of the highest priorities, because if those are dealt with, the essential issues like poverty, housing, education, our health institutions will have more funds to be able to operate within their spheres. Now, though I know that may sound like a bit of a Pollyanna approach of everything's going to be wonderful as long as we stop corruption, but I think it's got to start somewhere, and there needs to be a zero tolerance for corruption so that it's inculcated into everybody, not only into the members of parliament and other organizations, but into the whole country, that they should know that corruption is wrong, that crime is wrong, and that zero tolerance will be allowed, and that everybody who is caught or reported because of corruption must be dealt with. In regard to the linguistic landscape, one of the initiatives of the Public Protector is to have all materials and documents and official memoranda translated into all 11 official languages and provided in clinics, regional offices, etc., so that anybody with any language proficiency is able to formulate and submit a complaint if necessary. As far as I'm concerned, unfortunately, and it is unfortunate, I do not speak an African language. I speak English, Afrikaans, and some French. Bonjour. The practical examples of high-profile cases and ordinary. I think that the priority should be socioeconomic rights and how those are affected by corruption. And those are not necessarily the high-profile cases. they're probably the much more low-profile cases because they're people who are not known to everybody, but they have problems with housing, with getting paid by a government department, with education, with teachers, cash for jobs, teachers, etc. And these are the types of things that are insidious in our society, and it's something which is affecting the people right at grassroots level. And their socioeconomic rights need to be dealt with so that they can uplift themselves, education would improve, and therefore I believe that the high-profile cases may be one thing, but there probably should be more, but there are fewer than there must be at a grassroots level of socioeconomic rights cases, and those should be given priority.
Okay, Judge, thank you very much. Fandam, you seem to have a point exigency.
Yeah, I do. Okay. I asked a question about the relationship between Chapter 9 institutions and Parliament.
Yes.
Do you believe that Chapter 9 institutions are accountable to Parliament or merely just report to Parliament?
Well, there's slightly different aspects with the different Chapter 9 institutions, but insofar as the public protector is concerned, the office is answerable only to the Constitution and to law. It is not accountable to Parliament other than to report to Parliament. It's accountable to Parliament insofar as having to report and under the Public Finance Management Act and in those senses. But when you talk about accountable to Parliament? Can you just explain in which way are you saying? In the sense of they must take into account what? Well, my belief is that the establishment of the public protector is that the office is totally independent of Parliament and subject only to the Constitution and the law, and that no other organ or state, a parliamentary state, may interfere with the functioning, and they are accountable to the National Assembly and must report on their activities and performances of their functions at least once a year. So they're accountable in that sense of reporting on what they're doing, on their activities, obviously on their budgets, on other aspects in that sense, but not accountable in the sense of having to explain, for instance, why they had taken on a particular case.
Okay, I think Judge has answered that question, and I'm very happy with that answer. Judge, thank you very much. Is there anything that you would like to say before you leave? Just, it's a point of privilege now, because I'm really outside, I've run out of time.
Yes. No, I hope that I've answered everybody's questions, and have done so to the best of my ability. I thank you for listening to me.
Thank you very much, Judge. We will hear from us soon. Thank you. Bye-bye. Members, the next person that we're going to have now is Matibeng Chris Makodintwa. But members, you must remember, in as much as we are saying the hour, I also do want you to make sure that you all participate. Otherwise, you are going to accuse me of, you know, giving other people a chance to speak and others not, you know. So I am trying to balance, to strike the balance. And you must help me by not asking so long-winded questions.